Everybody, Mr. Harris made a suggestion to me that I think we will accept, and that is to move the executive officer's report up out of order because we have people in the audience that are waiting to speak to us on this, and the other items are really internal. So kind of to facilitate that, we're going to wait for 19, 20, and 21, and we're now going to take 22 up. Mr. Harris, would you like to tell us about your report?
The staff people for that part of that aren't in the room, so I just wanted to make sure you're aware of that. So
do we need to call them here?
We're getting them.
What I would suggest at this point, Mr. Chair, if we could, I think you have speakers for post-construction item and for the Morro Bay wastewater treatment. So maybe, no, but we have speakers. I thought maybe they could go ahead. The speakers could go ahead and.
Do we want staff?
Do we want staff?
Okay. Staff, I think, should kind of introduce. Lisa, are you able to introduce? Or Matt, are you able to introduce any of those
do you
items?
Can you go up and get. Katie is here, though. So
Katie,
let's go to Morro Bay.
I believe we had an EO report update on Morro Bay.
Yes, correct.
And I can introduce. We have Rob Livick here today from the city. He's Public Works Director. You have that right?
So public services.
Let me.
There we go.
maybe I'll give some background because I think this has to do with a letter that was written. Is that correct? So a little bit of background for the board. What happened was there was an agreement between the regional board and Morro Bay in terms of upgrading their plant to full secondary or tertiary. They currently have a 301H waiver with through US EPA, which allows them to have primary discharges to the ocean. And the regional board established, put together an agreement with them that gave them certain timelines for upgrading their plant and so that they could also get that 301H waiver. This past fall, the Coastal Commission was considering that because the plant is in the coastal zone, the Coastal Commission was considering whether or not to approve the permit for them to rebuild the plant in its current location. There was concern about the plant for a number of reasons, aesthetics, hazards due to tsunami, flooding, that kind of thing. And also the state board contacted me. We had a conference call between the Coastal Commission and state board to discuss what our agreement with Morro Bay meant in terms of what would happen if the Coastal Commission denied their permit. A week or two later, I got a call from the Coastal Commission Executive Director asking me if the regional board would write a letter to the Coastal Commission and did we have flexibility in terms of timing on the agreement that we had with them. I spoke to the chair about it. He was agreeable to it. We wrote a short one-page letter to the Coastal Commission chair expressing that we were willing to be flexible in terms of timing on the and what we would require under the agreement to allow the parties more time to discuss their options. Following that, the Coastal Commission met and denied the permit for construction in its current location. And that brings us to today, I believe. So
I think the one thing I'll add to that is that it's important to realize that it's actually a joint powers that operates the plant and does it. It's Cayucas and Morro Bay together. And so that was part of the discussion with regards to allowing them additional time to discuss and decide is that it's a bit of a coming together to make that decision at the JPA meetings versus just Morro Bay or just Cayucas. And Rob's here today with Morro Bay. I don't believe we have anybody here from Cayucas.
Okay. Go ahead. Come before us, Mr. Levin.
Yes. Good morning, Honorable Chairman Young, board members, and staff. My name is Rob Livick. I'm the Public Service Director and City Engineer for the City of Morro Bay. I'm here to give you a real brief update, although much has already been said of what I was going to talk about. You already know that the Coastal Commission denied our coastal development permit for construction of our wastewater treatment plant at its current location. And in summary, the reason for denial was the Coastal Commission's interpretation of our local coastal plan, including the areas of zoning inconsistency, failure to avoid coastal hazards, failure to include a sizable reclaimed water component in the project, and that the project is located within the LCP-designated sensitive view area. The Morro Bay staff will be working with our City Council on the next steps required to move forward with the project. And the city and the Cayuga Sanitary District will start looking at alternative locations for siting of a new wastewater treatment plant, and it will be on the agenda of the next JPA, the Joint Powers Agreement, meeting on February 14th, so it should be an enjoyable Valentine's Day evening for us all. And we look forward to working together with your staff, and we're currently setting up a meeting to discuss permitting, timing, and other water board issues. Our next step that we're bringing forward to our JPA is a detailed maintenance capital improvement plan to keep our plant operating safely, efficiently, and meeting all permit requirements over the next 5 to 10 years while a new plant site is selected, permitted, designed, and constructed. And I'm here to answer any questions that you may have about where we stand so far. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Johnston, then Dr. Hunter.
I'm a relatively new member to the board, so I wasn't, I understand this issue's been going on for a while. I did note in my packet that there was a settlement agreement that had some timelines for upgrades to the plant. Is this going to impact those timelines?
Yes.
Yes.
We had to have the plant up and operating by March 14th of 2014.
The new plant.
The new plant.
Doesn't sound like that was going to happen.
That's not going to happen.
There has been agreement that there was a force majeure clause enacted and agreed to when the Coastal Commission CDP process began, because we knew that would be a lengthy process and outside the control of the joint powers. So there's already been a delay to those dates that we've accepted and will take place. I think it's about a year and a half added on to those original dates, roughly. And so that's something we will have to look at, is not just the force majeure delay, but now how we handle the CDP being denied.
So obviously it's going to take more time to develop a new location than it would be to bring the old plant up to specs.
More than likely, yes, and I think that's a great deal of discussion that Morro Bay and Cayucas are going to entertain over the next month and a half.
Correct.
Thank you.
Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson asked one of my questions, so the timeline issue is clear. I'm also curious, I'd just like some more additional comments from you on the concern for maximizing use of recycled water to recharge groundwater basin, or what's your best understanding of that requirement?
The our LCP requirement is to, with the next upgrade of the wastewater treatment plant, is to include a recycled water component in the project. We did include a small recycled component. It was basically in-plant use and the surrounding area, some localized landscape irrigation. We have a reclaimed water study looking at the market, the near market for use of reclaimed water. And there's not a large market in Morro Bay for reclaimed water. We're already one of the most conserving coastal cities as far as water goes. We did a market analysis of the nearby agriculture, and there wasn't a whole lot of interest in reclaimed water if it was going to cost anything to deliver. If we could get it to the farms for free, they were willing to take reclaimed water, and both the Cayuga Sanitary District and Morro Bay are reluctant to provide this infrastructure at no cost. We need to make some changes to our own regulations that would allow delivery of water outside of the area. As far as groundwater recharge, we get most of our water from the State Water Project, and we supplement that with our local coastal aquifers and our desalinization plant. The Morrow Creek Aquifer is a very shallow, steep aquifer and does not lend itself readily to a lot of recharge. Most of it would flow out to the ocean if we were to put it into the ground there. But we do see some benefit to beneficial reuse in the Morrow Valley. It's just coming to terms over the costs and what the quality of water that we would deliver.
Just a follow-up then. So the current source of water for farming in the Morrow Valley is wells?
Well water, yes.
Well water. And is that having, how does that fit into the water balance for the for water supply? Because I understand that the city of Morrow Bay relies on state water, and that has a short-term, in the long sense of water supplies, that has a short-term issue associated with that. So is there any part of that discussion with farmers considering?
On any of this in any means. Exactly. So we're looking to take as much from anybody else that's done this before.
Okay. Mayor Delgado and then Mr. Johnston.
Yeah, first a question of confusion. Does your current wastewater treatment plant do any reclamation?
No.
Okay. So the proposed plant, do you have an estimated value per acre foot of the reclaimed water, what it would be?
An estimated cost or value?
Value on the market. So when you tried to market it to the...
When we tried to market it, when we sent out our survey, we basically gave a range of costs, and it would cost between $1,000 to $2,000 an acre foot to deliver reclaimed water, depending where in the watershed that would be. And what we got back was if it costs more than our well pumping costs, we weren't interested at this time.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. I have one speaker card. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One speaker card, Steve Schimmick.
I'm sorry. Steve Schimmick, the Otter Project. I would remind the board that there is a petition to the State Water Board that on your decision to grant a waiver, and it is in abeyance. It was recently renewed. And I would hope that if there was a discussion to extend their permit, that there would be a check-in with some of the other stakeholders. There is tremendous dissatisfaction over the delays, some of which the suspicion is that these delays have been, frankly, of their own doing. It was identified a long time ago that the site was not acceptable to the Coastal Commission, and so it was the insistence to go ahead with this site that has led to the delay. So,
could you, since I'm not familiar with it, the petition? Can you tell me who filed the petition and what was it? What was the issue over?
So I'm actually, so it was NRDC and the Otter Project. If you remember David Beckman being here several times. So it was put into abeyance. And, to ask me exactly what it is, I would have to go research that. It was a while back.
It was when the permit was issued and the settlement agreement was done. The petition is held in abeyance because the settlement agreement is in place, and the basics are that the settlement agreement says the next issuance of the permit by the regional board will not include a 301H waiver, and Morrow Bay will, or the joint powers would not apply for a 301H waiver. We have not had any discussions to the contrary with that, and we do expect that the reported waste discharge, or in other words, the application for renewal of a permit that would be due in June of this year for their next permit would not include a 301H waiver application.
I just would add and finish up by saying that this is a serious concern for the Otter project. This isn't, you know, what this is about is the fact that it within Estero Bay, like literally biologists from, frankly, USGS have suggested that, that Estero Bay is where otters go to die. The number of otters found dead and stranded on the beaches of Estero Bay eclipse the number of otters found dead in, or stranded on any other part of the coast. So, and the problems that we have are disease, and so when we look at the issues of disease, one of the very first things we look at is water quality. And in the middle of this bay, you have a person that's discharging for years under a waiver from the Clean Water Act.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Shemek. Okay.
May I ask a follow-up of Katie?
Sure.
So if the permit, the next permit renewal will not have, will not include this waiver, and it's, and the plant is designed for, with the, as primary treatment only, right?
It would be designed, with the design versus the permit is a little different, but we would not include any waiver of full secondary treatment. So
does that mean they're going to have to invest capital investment to upgrade the current site, knowing that they're going to have to move the location and
that will
totally
be,
construct a new site?
That will be part of the joint powers discussions over the next couple months, is they need to rally to figure out how their timing impacts the cost, the potential liabilities they face with mandatory minimum penalties for effluent violations with their new permit being full secondary, and the length of time to achieve that. That's an active discussion we're having.
And what's the time frame for this again?
The application is due this summer. The permit expires, excuse me, early next year. So next year you'll be seeing a new permit up for consideration. So the timing's actually relatively quick.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yes, Dr. Wolf.
And this comment is in regard to the cost of pumping, and I just thought about this. As you're probably aware, PG&E is installing smart meters throughout the county, including agriculture land. Once they're installed, agriculture pumping meters will be time of day used rate structure, which is going to change significantly the cost of pumping. And in some agriculture application, there is not necessarily going to be the flexibility of pumping at night during low rate versus daytime. So you may, once these new rates are in place, you know, revisit the cost of pumping versus, you know, your program that you were proposing.
Okay. This was an informational item. Thank you very much. Let's move on, Mr. Harris, to another component of the EO report.
So Phil Hammer is here, so we might want to go to the post-construction requirements, because I believe we have a couple of cards for speakers.
Okay.
Okay, well, good morning. I'm Phil Hammer. I'm the supervisor for the stormwater unit. In your executive officer report, I provided a status report on the post-construction requirements that you all adopted in September of 2012. And that status report is in response to the December 2012 board meeting, when you heard comments from stakeholders on the post-construction requirements and how they interact with the phase two permit, the draft phase two permit the state board is considering for adoption. And at the December 2012 meeting, you directed staff to work with stakeholders to address their concerns. And we've been doing that, and the staff report describes some of those efforts. We've been working with both the state board staff and the stakeholders to ensure that we can continue to implement our post-construction requirements under the Phase 2 permit, and that the Phase 2 permit will allow us to modify those if we find any modifications to be necessary. And we've also been working with stakeholders to address technical issues with post-construction requirements, specifically the issue that was raised at the December meeting about the multiplier that's used to determine how much water needs to be retained on site. So we've been working on both those issues, and the status report describes that. However, the status report was written over a month ago, and since that time there's been some developments with the Phase 2 permit that I'd like to go over and give you an update on. Previously, the Phase 2 permit incorporated our post-construction requirements in their entirety as an attachment, but that has changed now based on comments from stakeholders, and now the permit is much more vague about how it deals with our post-construction requirements, in that it just allows a regional water board to develop its own post-construction requirements as long as they're watershed process based. And so with this draft language, you know, it appears that we'll be able to maintain our control over our post-construction requirements and our process to modify them if necessary.
Excuse me, are you referring to the to the state board permit?
I am.
Okay, I was confused.
And so that permit, the state board permit, is draft, and it's expected to be adopted on Tuesday. But since the permit is draft, you know, rather get into a lot of details today on what it means for our post-construction requirements, we suggest coming back to you in March with an agendized item, and that would happen after the state board permit has been adopted. And that way we'll know for certain what the permit, the state board permit, says, and we can make a recommendation on how to proceed at that time. So in March, what we would suggest to do is be to present to you staff's plan for moving forward with the post-construction requirements in light of the Phase 2 permit, as well as how we plan to address ongoing stakeholder concerns. And then at that time, both the board and stakeholders would have the opportunity to provide input on our plan. And we would anticipate that the plan that we would present to you in March would identify the steps necessary that we need to take to implement the post-construction requirements under the draft permit. And it would identify specific post-construction requirements that we plan to assess to see if they if modification is warranted. We'd also describe the stakeholder process we plan to follow to deal with these issues, and then provide you with a schedule as well. And then as a follow-up to that March presentation of our plan to move forward with the post-construction requirements, you know, if we determine that a regional board action is needed on the post-construction requirements, that we would bring that action item back to you in July. So in summary, what we suggest to do is to wait until the Phase 2 permit is adopted, which should be on Tuesday, and then take that final permit, assess it, and come back to you in March with our plan for moving forward with implementing the post-construction requirements, and then bring to you in July any action item that may be necessary to deal with the permit and any ongoing technical issues that stakeholders may have. And that's all I have today to present, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Mr. Johnston.
I have a couple questions.
Sure.
And maybe I'll give them both to you, and you can arrange your answer however you like. I'm just curious as to where you are in the JERT process on hashing through the 1.963 multiplier.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make sure what I took away from your comments are that if the state board permit passes as we expect it to, which is nothing's done till it's done, that the 1.963 won't be part of the state one, or that it will essentially have control over our own destiny in that area at the regional level?
Yeah, we'll have control over the post-construction requirements in total.
Okay.
If the permit, the state board permit, is adopted as it's currently drafted.
So the two questions then I'd like to hear are where we are in the JERT and the stakeholder process on the 1.963,
mm-hmm.
And secondly, there was a whole series of anticipated timelines regarding Sydney ordinances and such when we passed our order on this some months back, and is that going to be impacted here?
Yeah, I'm going to address the ordinance issue first, and I think I'll try and see if Dominic has something to provide on the 1.963. He's been working more closely on that than I have. In terms of the ordinance issue and timing, and does this necessitate any kind of change in timing, we don't think it does. Any change that we may need to make to the post-construction requirements to make them implementable under the Phase 2 permit would, in our view, be procedural, be minor. Any kind of technical changes we need to make are very specific and very targeted, and we don't think those changes, such as to the multiplier, would prevent the cities from moving forward on their ordinances at this time. And we've been doing a lot of work with the cities to prepare them for implementation. We've been developing guidance documents. We've been meeting with them all to see what their progress is on their ordinances. And what we're finding is that a lot of the cities are going to reference the requirements. So the ordinance is going to reference the requirements so that they can change, so those requirements can be changed. And so if some changes to the requirements happen, you know, it shouldn't be a problem with the ordinances because the ordinances are just referencing the requirements and they should be able to change those. So on that issue, I think we're still in a good situation with the timeline. And I don't think that this the State Board permit throws a wrench in our timeline. And Dominic can talk to about the multiplier.
Yeah, your question, this is Dominic Rock with the Central Coast Water Board, and your question concerned the progress we were making on examining the multiplier and whether there's an alternative to that. And there's a subcommittee of the Joint Effort Review Team that was formed to begin to develop potential alternatives. They've made significant progress. We actually met with the chair of that subcommittee yesterday, our staff did, and another member of the subcommittee, and we discussed where they seem to be headed in terms of addressing the multiplier issue. And we conveyed to them as staff that we were comfortable with that direction and the progress they're making. It seems to be timely, and we expect to have a fairly good outcome probably within a couple of months, and that certainly would be consistent with their progress toward adopting the ordinances as well. So
it would be safe to say that at this point it appears to staff, and nothing is done until it's done, but it appears to staff that this will probably be resolved in a way that at least most, if not all, of the cities are able to live with.
Well, that's the idea of the subcommittee, is that it represents the interest and concerns of the stakeholders. So the folks in that subcommittee are very cognizant of those concerns. They're developing an approach that is meant to address those concerns. And then when they're finished with their work, we'll bring that back to the full committee for a review. But that's the idea, that we should be addressing most of those concerns.
And we can provide you with an update on that progress in March, and you'll have full opportunity to revisit the issue if we do have an action item in July.
Okay. Thank you very much. I have a few speakers that wish to address us on this matter. Why don't we start with this list? We have Agnes Topp, then Allison Tom, and then Rob's last name is what? Rob?
Robert Ketley.
Ketley. Rob Ketley. Okay. And then also, oh yeah, okay. That's what this other card is. So it's just the three of you. Great.
3 minutes?
No. 3 minutes for the first one, 2 minutes for the second one, and 5 minutes for the last one.
Good morning. Agnes won't make it this morning. She was ill. So
I mean,
we're down to two. But I'm Allison Tom, and I work for the County of Santa Cruz as a civil engineer,
And my comments this morning were related to schedule and deadlines, as you have already addressed somewhat. I would say from the county's perspective, we find that these deadlines will be quite difficult to meet in terms of ordinances and criteria and everything being updated by September of this year. A lot of the work that we do really relies on having the final requirements in place in order to do a complete review of our ordinances criteria and determine how those need to be updated. We do anticipate also needing to have communications and potential hearings with the Coastal Commission to update these ordinances and criteria, as well as in our own public process locally, which requires quite a bit of lead time. So some of our work really does delay start until we have these final criteria to make that final comparison.
Has, you know, this has been on the books, you know, approaching for some time. Did the city anticipate?
No, yes, we have. I'm with the County of Santa Cruz. Actually, we skipped the City of Santa Cruz.
So Agnes is not here at all?
She's not.
Gotcha. Okay, I missed that.
But yes, we have anticipated, and in fact, a complication perhaps to the process as well, as we have also applied to use our pre-existing criteria in lieu of the post-development requirements that your board adopted in September. So we're actually working through some of that with staff right now. If that works out, I think much of the timelines will be eased from our perspective. Mm-hmm. If we're using our existing criteria, there's a lot less work in terms of updating that we need to do. But if we aren't able to use our existing criteria and we need to go through and particularly if we have to update ordinances, there's quite a bit of lead time we'll need.
Mr. Johnston.
Now, what about the concept of referencing the permit requirements in the ordinances rather than, as was brought up by staff, as a shortcut time-wise?
Yes, I think we are looking at that as a possibility. Kind of depends on what those requirements really look like. And we do have existing requirements in ordinance now. So if they're in conflict, if they end up being in conflict with some of that, we'll need to update ordinance either way, I guess. I am a member of the JURT as well. And my understanding in terms of status of ordinance updates and so forth was that there was going to potentially be like draft ordinances that we could use, or a procedure that was suggested by board members, and that would be something that I think we would probably be discussing at the next JURT meeting. So I hadn't heard definitively that a reference in ordinance was going to be acceptable, but perhaps I'm hearing that today.
Is there a question for me or?
So what I'm hearing from you is that you may or may not be able to make the timelines, Santa Cruz County, that if there are draft ordinances that your understanding was that we were going to prepare some draft ordinances, and that this is the first you're hearing of draft ordinances that reference the requirements rather than specifying them.
It's not the first I'm hearing of that possibility. It's the first I'm hearing that that's an acceptable way. On the JURT, I think we discussed all sorts of different ways of incorporating these criteria, and I believe that probably different jurisdictions will incorporate these requirements in different ways. But I hadn't heard definitively that reference was adequate.
Does staff want to respond to that? There seems to be a misunderstanding or question.
So let's make sure we are talking about the exact same thing here, everybody. When a jurisdiction adopts development criteria, stormwater development standards, anything like that. It has a couple of different approaches to doing that. One is to adopt an ordinance referencing a set of criteria, leaves them out of the ordinance. That's called incorporation by reference, generally. Occasionally, there are specific elements of a design requirement or criteria that are actually brought into the body of the ordinance. But in general, our municipalities have all conveyed to us that their preference and typical approach is to avoid having to bring language directly into the ordinance and instead referring to them by reference so that they could make changes periodically and update those standards. The Joint Effort Review Team, has discussed this multiple times at meetings about what is the process you use, what's the best way that the Water Board can assist you in ensuring that this goes smoothly. And a couple of issues have come up. The issue of the Coastal Commission's role has been an issue. And the other is the overall acceptability of referring to something by reference. And the Water Board staff has never put an obstacle to referring to the standards by reference. That's not been something we're opposed to. What we want to ensure is that they're enforceable and that those ordinances refer to something that is enforceable and that the thing is, in fact, the post-construction requirements that you adopted. So the discussion kind of circles around that. At times, there's been the discussion that the Water Board staff or a group of municipalities could develop some draft language that would make it just that much easier for a municipality to just grab the language, put it in their ordinance, and give it to their council or their supervisors. And but because there are so many different variations on the theme in terms of adopting ordinances and existing ordinance language and the various municipal code vehicles that are used, that has not really come to fruition. Nobody has really said, yes, let's do that. Let's develop some stock language or model language. In fact, we've had many people say, we won't use it if you give it to, if you prepare it. So that has never really evolved into a task that the JURT is working on. Our staff has contacted most of the jurisdictions to just basically query them on the process that they use. And the results of that have been very, very fruitful. One, with regards to the Coastal Commission role, and two, with the allowing the Water Board staff to give clarity on what we're accepting in terms of an approach. So we sent out an email that I thought went to all municipalities that stated that the Water Board is comfortable with this incorporation by reference approach. That's what I was kind of asking Phil about. Didn't we send that to everybody? Because maybe Allison hasn't seen that. So, but the issue is resolved from the point of view of staff that incorporation by reference is completely acceptable into an ordinance. So there's no barrier there. A remaining kind of gray area is how the Coastal Commission's jurisdiction affects the process of ordinance adoption and consistency with local coastal programs. And the Coastal Commission staff and our staff have worked together. We have a representative from the Coastal Commission on the Joint Effort Review Team explaining their interests. And so we feel we have all the people in the room that can make that work out and come up with an approach that works. But one thing we are clear on is that the Water Board has no authority to make the Coastal Commission adopt anything, all right? So we can't enforce upon the commission a process that in any way, is different from what they normally use, which is to review ordinances, as you know from being a coastal city, many of you, reviewing ordinances and approving them before they're enforceable. And so that entire world of LCP consistency with ordinance and coastal jurisdiction control over reviewing ordinance language is it's their process. We want it to go smoothly, obviously. We want these cities to be able to implement these regulations without some thing hanging over their head at the commission. So our approach has been to work with the Coastal Commission staff to ensure they understand what we're doing understand the importance of the cities being able to pursue implementation. So, but I'll definitely follow up with you, Allison, just to make sure we haven't missed you on a communication.
Okay, thank you very much. Rob Ketley, and then I have Courtney Trask, actually. Tricia Wotan first, then Courtney Trask.
And I can definitely do mine in under 5 minutes, and if I'm any good, under three. Chairman Young, members of the board, ladies and gentlemen, Robert Ketley, City of Watsonville. I'm a member of the JERT, member of the JERT, is it subsection D review team? And we've got to get a better acronym than that. The team that also worked on the applicability thresholds. I'd like to actually, as I did at the State Water Resources Control Board, reframe the perspective in terms of looking at this from a watershed rather than from a municipality in a phase two perspective. And before I do that, let me just say one thing. I really do want to commend regional board staff for working on this. It's a bold approach, and they've been very helpful and very good. So, the City of Watsonville is fully supportive of the WMZ-based approach to stormwater management. However, we believe it is necessary to look at this issue in a much broader watershed context. The current approach is primarily hydrology-based. It should be considered a first step in the process of managing development-related stormwater in watersheds. For example, there are a number of very important biological factors that need to be brought into the discussion at some point. No disrespect to DALA, but LID is not NID. Low impact development is not no impact development. So as we condition development within phase two municipalities, we need to be cognizant of the fact that that could have repercussions in the broader watershed. If something becomes economically unviable within a phase two entity, there's a possibility that it could become economically viable outside of phase two in an area where there are no regulations managing stormwater or limited regulations. So we need to get this right. I can certainly design a road from a hydraulic point of view. That doesn't have any difference in hydraulic signature. But if I'm an amphibian that has to get from point A to point B across that road, that really doesn't matter too much. Those cars are still going to squish me. So I would like to recommend that the board direct staff to work with stakeholders to refine the post-construction requirements to address these other critical watershed issues. I'm not suggesting we do this right away. This could be an iterative process using data from actual projects as they come about over the next few years. Okay, on to the multiplier. As I mentioned, I'm on the JERT D, or whatever our name is now, group that's actually trying to evaluate that. As Phil and Dominic have said, we believe we're making good progress here. There are a few things that still remain to be hashed out. The question is, does the 95th percent event need a multiplier to meet the objectives? It doesn't look like it does under all circumstances, so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to come up with something to fit that. The infeasibility criteria need to be worked on. There's still some grey areas there. And we also would like to discuss the opportunity to have hydrograph-type analysis that could be applied to sizing retention facilities, and I'll get to that very quickly in a few seconds. Last but not least, on the multiplier and the attachment D, there is a disconnect between water quality requirements in the PCRs and attachment D that we need to resolve. So last but not least, let's talk about the 95th percentile event. I've had discussions with the individual at EPA who generated this for Section 438 of the EISA, trying to find out how they came about using this criteria. And to capture two of his comments, I think, that really helped crystallize this, he stated, "We felt that the 95th percentile represented a reasonable performance standard that would manage runoff on site for most of the small storms. It is a blunt instrument that can be sharpened with local data." He also stated, "I think reason must prevail in this case. It is ridiculous to require continuous simulation modeling analysis on small, i.e. less than 1 acre, sites. It just doesn't make sense." So capturing those two elements, The 95th percentile is a blunt instrument. It's sort of like a flat tax at 30%. Continuous simulation modeling is sort of like hiring a tax accountant. For some projects, either one of those may make perfect sense. But for a number of projects, we're going to need something like H&R Block or TurboTax to deal with those and get a better approach.
Could you wrap it up, Mr. Ketley?
Yeah, it's coming right now. Recommend that the board allow the JERT time to use local data to sharpen the tool and provide reasonable alternatives to continuous simulation modeling. Done.
And I got the impression from hearing from staff that they were going to be doing this with the committee as they continued with implementation and fine-tuning these issues. Do you have some sense that that's not going to happen?
I'm not certain. I certainly hope that is the case. I'm just trying to make sure that we all have a clear understanding that there are still some outstanding issues that need to be addressed.
And this is going to come back to us after we find out, after we know for certain that the State Board has adopted the permit.
Mm-hmm.
Staff is going to bring this back. You'll have another opportunity, you know, to report back to us yourself on how things are going.
I look forward to it.
And maybe you can work on a new acronym.
Yeah,
for your committee. Yeah.
Really, you're right. JERT-D really is bad.
It's lacking. Mr. Johnston.
You mentioned a couple of other issues other than the 95th percentile. Is this subcommittee working on that range of issues? Are those currently all in the process of being chewed upon?
Currently, we're working specifically on the multiplier as it relates to the 95th percentile. I'm hoping that we'll be able to have the opportunity to look at issues like the infeasibility criteria, because I think they do have a significant impact on the ultimate way in which we manage development.
And does that comport with staff's understanding of where we're going?
Yes, it does.
And as for the comment about down the road, as we start to get results from projects, in doing some continuing follow-up on a watershed basis, does that comport with staff's understanding of where we're going as well?
It comports with staff's understanding, and it actually comports with the language of the post-construction requirements, which provide for the opportunity for municipalities to examine watershed-based approaches. We anticipated the need to do that.
I just wanted to add, I was glad to hear Robert talk about kind of more short-term and long-term concepts, and that there's some things that we can address on the short-term pretty clearly, like the multiplier, and other things that may take some more time, and we'll try and make distinguish between those for you all in March.
Good work.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you.
Okay. Tricia Wotan?
Three. Hi, my name is Tricia Wotan. I'm with the City of Monterey. And first, I too just want to say I realize this has been a really big effort on the part of Regional Board staff, and we do appreciate the work they've done. We also feel strongly that water resources, it's important that they're managed on a watershed basis. And so in many respects, this is a great direction that we're going. One of the things, though, that I just want to bring up with regard to, a regional board staff has been excellent in coming up and speaking to different groups in the Monterey region. The City of Monterey has been working with CSPE, and then the Monterey Regional Group has been working with the AIA group up there. And your staff has been coming up and really trying to help get the word out and educate people on this. So that's been really excellent. Just getting back a little bit to what Allison was saying earlier with the County of Santa Cruz. In September, you adopted these requirements, and the plan was to implement them by September 2013. In about a month or so later, maybe 2 months later, we learned that they were now going to be put into the phase two permit, and they were then once again sort of open for comment and potential revision. So we've been sort of waiting with bated breath on that. Then recently we saw the verbiage that's in the fact sheet of the phase two permit, and that sort of presents another change on this path. And so getting back to local agency process, I just wanted to state one of the pieces in that is CEQA. And when you're bringing together a CEQA determination, you do need what's called a finite, stable, and accurate project description so that you can make your CEQA determination as to whether there are going to be any significant environmental impacts that you need to mitigate. And so from the City of Monterey standpoint, we've really been waiting for the final product so that we can then start on the path we need to make the code revisions or code revision with reference to a guidance document that we need to. But we've sort of been waiting through this process. And so what I would just want to mention is that even though they were final for you in September of 2012, it kept being sort of reopened and things have changed. And so we've been waiting for a finite, stable, accurate project so we can do the CEQA documentation that's necessary to go forth with any code revisions or new ordinances. And then lastly, I just wanted to state that we have been bringing up throughout this whole process and even at the State Water Board the concern, the legal concern we have with regard to ministerial projects being included in this. The verbiage that's in these requirements went into the Phase 2 permit but were subsequently removed by the State Water Board after review, and that language was revised for applicability to the types of development projects. And so I've just asked if through this JERT process, I'm not involved in the JERT, I've just been on the outside but following this closely, if that conversation could be had with the State Water Board legal staff as to why they removed ministerial projects from being applicable to E12 in the Phase 2 permit, because I think that might also be something that needs to be understood here with regard to the post-construction requirements.
Thank you for your comments. Can staff comment on that?
Regarding the ministerial issue,
we've
heard that argument continually. We heard it during the Salinas permit. We heard it during adoption of these post-construction requirements. We fully vetted that comment and responded to it. Why the state board changed their language, I don't know. But we found that these requirements can be applied through ministerial actions. As long, it depends on how you write your ministerial requirements.
Do you know who the contact is at the state board?
I do. It's Eric Bernstein. I can call him and check in with him on that. I would expect that they just made the change in response to a comment without having the background on the issue that we have.
Okay. I mean, either you could make the call or you can give Tricia his name and phone number, and she can follow up directly.
I'll follow up with that.
Yeah. Okay. I'm kind of curious if, I mean, and I hear this municipality is waiting for something final to be generated before they do any ordinance changes. How come we're not hearing that kind of issue expressed by all the municipalities that have to comply with this?
They're there.
The next speaker. Okay. All right. Courtney Trask.
So you'll hear that from me. Hi. I'm with UC Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
So we run a little bit different than our typical municipality.
Your name, please.
Courtney Trask.
Courtney Trask.
Yeah, UC Santa Cruz. And so I actually started the process of taking the document that was supplied and editing it, because for us, the way that it's written, we have campus standards. We don't have ordinances. And so when it refers to a project or a project proponent, that is us. We propose our own projects. We enforce all of the campus standards, that kind of thing. And so I have to change the language to turn into our consultants and our design teams that we hire. So it has to read to make sense to them, to be able to put into their contracts. And so I started that process of updating that and editing the document. But when I found out that there were going to be some edits and some changes, I stopped doing that because it's quite a lengthy document to go through and edit. And so for me, and then get those into my campus standards on top of that. And there, we do have an internal review process to make that happen. So while it's not as lengthy as a municipality going through city council and whatnot, it is still a process. And so for me, I have to wait for that final document to be able to implement for campus projects. So I just thought I'd add to that timeline question.
Did you have anything else?
Nope, that's it.
Okay. Now, you're the University of California.
Yes.
Which is a different entity.
So we are non-traditional.
Yeah,
yes.
I understand. And so my question really was, as to all the other municipalities, Can you tell us about the city of Santa Barbara? Has it updated its ordinance? Do you know?
Can't answer that.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Can staff tell us
whether
Santa Barbara's working on their update?
Okay.
Yeah. They were a pre-existing program though.
Okay.
But you know they're moving forward with the revision of the ordinance.
Have any any municipal entities already updated their ordinances? Or are they all waiting?
I don't think any of them have informed us that they've completed the update.
Okay,
yet.
So
they're all working on it.
They need to wait for the final document.
No. They can move forward. As I said, they can adopt by reference.
By reference, okay.
Which most of them are planning to do,
okay.
In which case whatever is their referencing could change. But
okay. All right, Mr. Johnston.
What about the statement that was made that to prepare their the CEQA documentation that goes along with the revised ordinance or code, that they need to have a final, stable,
accurate.
Accurate. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's never been presented as an obstacle to us, to ordinance adoption or to this process. The CEQA concerns come up, but they seem to go away fairly quickly. And I think in other parts of the state where we've seen the stormwater standards adopted, that issue is resolved in some manner. I mean, the lead agency, being the ordinance adopting agency, can make a finding, and they've been able to do that with the project descriptions they have. I think I told you when you adopted the post-construction requirements that this is a work in progress. It's continually evolving, and getting it right is going to take decades probably, but we have to get something started before it becomes a meaningful process. And there's a lot of reasons people want to delay, and legitimate reasons no doubt, but that doesn't change the fact that there will always be a need to evolve and refine these kinds of requirements. So we can't really ever get them 100% entirely fixed and correct and right and then move forward. So I think it's just part of this kind of a process of regulation, developing regulations, is some degree of uncertainty is going to always be there with the adoption of any particular code. And that hasn't really been an obstacle in the adoption of codes throughout the state. So we're surprised to hear that would be problematic and unique to our municipalities. I don't know if you wanted to comment.
I would just add that it's a real common timeline for updating ordinances and permits is 1 year. Most times when a stormwater permit is adopted, the municipalities have 1 year to get their ordinances in place and implement the new program, and that's what we've given the municipalities here in our region.
Okay, I have one additional speaker, Tom Hardy. Yeah.
So if you allowed 1 year, you're talking about 1 year from September. And is that written into the post-construction requirements? Is that the timeline locked in? So in the JERT process that's going on now to hammer out this attachment D issue, which will then create those CEQA level criteria that some have identified as an issue for them. Is that a point at which the timeline can be reconsidered, reviewed, and under a reasonable look at where the municipalities are, we may need to extend that timeline? Is that something in the works as well?
When this comes back in March, we'll look at that.
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering if that's part of the discussion with the JERT.
Okay. Well, in March, if once we find out what's happened, if we can go ahead and grant additional time if need be. If they tell us that they're going to need more time, that comes up in the JERT process, it becomes an issue.
Okay, sure.
We're on board with that.
This is the first we heard of this issue today.
Okay.
So, Mr. Johnson.
So it's not going to be an action item in March, though, will it? We're talking about report in March, action item in July. Is that correct? Which is 2 months before September. I mean, I'm a little concerned, too, because I understand that a year is a normal timeline to put in place the ordinances and implement the program, but the program is still really being worked here. I mean, I understand most of it's there, but so I'm a little concerned if we don't have an action item till July, and I don't know, just expressing.
Well,
that.
Do you want to put one? Do we need an action item? And two, do you want to include an action item in the March agenda item just as a heads up that we may consider extending time if need be? Does it have to be real accurate as to when that would be?
You mean, does the action item in March need to be accurate?
In terms of when, how far we would extend something, extend the completion date.
Well, the draft would be the draft that you'd have to put out.
The draft notice?
Or the draft LID requirements that include, yeah. Okay. You can't just make them on the fly at the board meeting.
Okay. So I think what she's saying is if you're proposing a change, you'd have to propose a specific change to the LID resolution. That was the resolution that came that.
I think there's been two changes we can be pretty confident about now, with the acknowledgement that the state board permit has not yet been adopted.
Right.
One would be some kind of procedural modification to our resolution to make it apply under the new state board permit. The other is addressing the multiplier issue. Those two things are, and the 99.9% of the rest of the post-construction requirements wouldn't change. So I think those two minor changes shouldn't hold anybody back from meeting the September deadline. We can certainly look at the possibility of bringing you an action item in March, but the public noticing requirements and when we would have to have all the documentation together is something that I can't answer right now if we can do that or not, but we can look at that.
Staff doesn't feel that should create an impediment. Dr. Wolf, and then Mayor Delgado, and then Dr. Hunter.
I think, you know, you used a numerical value, which I was just going to bring up. I'm a little confused. I think here the concerns to add more time is to try to reach perfection. Well, if we with fine-tuning the 99.9% and better, I think there's a point where you got to draw the line. Otherwise, 10 years from now, we'll still be talking about this. So I'm a little confused about additional time requirement when we're down now to what I would call the fine-tuning versus, you know, the bulk of the needs. And, CEQA process, and that an acronym I wrote FASAP, but that's because I couldn't remember that long sentence. I'm a little concerned that perhaps we'd be too premature saying, well, okay, let's consider extension based on the fact that right now I think unless I misunderstand, we're looking at fine-tuning the language. And September, I mean, is still a long ways from now, so a lot can be done between now and then. So that, I guess that's my input, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mayor Delgado?
If March turns out to be some sort of an action item or not, I thought that having a letter sent to all the relevant jurisdictions to bring them up to date on what our position is on the status of this, the current schedule, including the September timeframe, and then suggesting an outline of steps that we think they should or could be taking, such as getting going on ordinances that incorporate by reference, then everyone's on the same page, and the degree to which they make progress between now and our action date, whether it be July or March, could help us determine whether it's in good faith requests for extensions, because I don't know of a big decision we've made where the major proponents whether it be the TMDLs or the ag order or the MS4 permits, weren't saying that we need more time on something that's been worked on for quite some time before it comes to us. So I just don't ever see that we're going to be somewhere where people are lining up saying, we've had plenty of time, we're ready to go on this, but we should help them along by suggesting what we think are appropriate sequences they can embark upon to get going on this.
That seems reasonable. Dominic?
That is exactly the strategy we've undertaken without a formal letter. In fact, I have a to-do item, which is after this meeting and after the adoption next Tuesday, sending out a letter to the municipalities. But informally, or in the non-written correspondence mode, we have scheduled and met with many of the municipalities, and we have identified specific milestones that we expect them to be achieving in order to remain on track with ordinance adoption and development of other implementation strategies. So that, and the great thing is that it's not just me anymore. We've disseminated and delegated some of this work to the rest of the unit. So each of the unit staff who has program areas in the north, central, and throughout the region are meeting with the municipal stakeholders, and they're going over them individually. Here's where you need to be. Where are you at with that? And that process has been both informative in terms of letting us know whether someone is completely off track or incapable or lacking capacity, but it's also informed us as to the typical strategy that they're following, which is what I was able to report to you. Most of them are considering adoption by ordinance, by reference, rather. So we actually are doing exactly what you're describing, and we intended to formalize it in a letter. So thanks for describing that.
Dr. Hunter, then Mr. Johnston.
Yeah, my comments are similar to Mr. Delgado, and I totally agree that formalizing it in a letter, especially given that Phil commented that this is not something he's heard before, so clearly everybody needs to be on the same page, pun, ha. But the letter also gets beyond the staff person who may need a little support in conveying to the decision makers, which is the elected body, you know, that this is something that's on track. Here's where we are relative to our other fellow members of the JURT, and we need to move this up as a priority, and here's the timeline. And we still have time to move forward and meet these deadlines. But I think the formal letter always goes a little further in giving, you know, each of the municipalities a little support.
Mr. Johnston, and then Mr. Jordan.
Well, perhaps what makes sense then, if there's going to be a July action item, is to include in the July presentation an update on where the cities are on the ordinances. If staff at that point is recommending any extension of time, they can say so. And if staff is not recommending an extension of time, they can say that, which would, I think, then put it on the table for us if we choose to deal with it. Is that correct, Council?
Yes, you could make changes at the board meeting to accommodate an extension.
Okay, so maybe that can just be part of the July report, how we're doing and staff's recommendation as to whether there needs to be any push on that or not. Mm-hmm. So we're operating with a little more information than we are now.
Okay, Mr. Jordan, and then Mr. Hardy, please come up before anyone else asks me to speak.
So it's almost like we're doing an informal polling on this subject, so I'll just chime in that I agree wholeheartedly with Dr. Wolf, and I think also wholeheartedly support staff in their desire not to recommend extension be part of the language or part of the action at any future meeting. You know, it's clear to me that even the great suggestions that come up here at the table, staff is far out in front of this already with the suggestions they're hearing on what the work they're doing with the outreach and milestones and where we are. And I think clearly if you're dragging your feet, you've been dragging your feet. And there's others who aren't dragging their feet. And they need to just be pushed along, and that deadline needs to be held fast.
Mr. Hardy, quickly.
Thank you. Yes, very quickly. Tom Hardy from Monterey County Public Works Department, and we have been working with the one thing that I do want to echo first off is just you've heard, I think, from everyone unanimously that working with staff has been just very productive, and I'd say that completely. Working with Dominic and everyone has been very fruitful, and the JERT, I'm on the JERT as well, has been productive, and we're looking forward to moving ahead. But I would also echo requirements from Santa Cruz County and the city of Monterey, too, that the process that we have to go through to get something adopted is not a quick process. So we are working diligently toward meeting the goals. One of the things I'm hesitating to spin us in a direction, but working with the Coastal Commission, one of their very specific requirements has been that we do include word for word the post-construction requirements in the document. So we're still waiting for them as well to iron out some type of agreement. Everything is moving forward. Internally, we would, I think, certainly have something in place by the September deadline, but has yet to be seen. We heard it yesterday afternoon, too, just when people, everything's up in the air. No one knows what to do. One of the gentlemen spoke yesterday about, you know, implementing something that he wasn't going to get credit for, I think was the word he used. And no one wants to get too far ahead for fear of having to start over again. So that's all. Thank you.
Mayor Delgado.
Quick question, Tom. Thank you. Did the Coastal Commission requirement for word for word allow for incorporation by reference, or they wanted to see word for word within the ordinance?
What I've heard so far in the JERT meetings is that they were asking, everything I've heard so far from them was that they were asking word for word into the adoption. They do not like to do anything by reference. So it's one of the issues that do have to be ironed out.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. This concludes this individual portion of the EO report. Thank you both very much. Okay. And thank you for your continued sustained effort on this. Mr. Harris, so we have a few more items. Do we want to just see, does the board have any questions on the remainder of the EO report, any portions of it? Because we tried to take care of everything that we anticipated public comment on. And if we don't, what we could do is break for lunch, go into closed session on an item we're going to announce, and then we'll come back and clean up.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just to let you know, lunch is not here yet.
Ah.
They're really busy down there, so they're expecting it to be here at 12:30.
Okay. Yeah, let's see. What do we have next? That's going to take longer.
So, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
We still haven't heard if there are any further questions from any of the board members. I don't know if they on any of these items.
All right. Are there any questions? Okay. Dr. Hunter? And this is on the EO report.
Yes, on the EO report.
Okay.
In the groundwater assessment and protection six-month update, I made a note to myself that there are 10 agencies or districts that have made a verbal commitment to begin entering their data into GeoTracker. But then I also made a note, so I'm trying to sort this out quickly, four have actually provided data, I think is where we're at. So I just want to get staff discussion on how that's going.
I'd like to make a clarification. What the CEO report does say is that we have been actively engaging with 10 local agency programs, and then we've gotten verbal commitments from four of those.
Okay.
And now we're currently pursuing what we need to do to start getting those data reported up into GeoTracker.
Okay.
Would you should introduce yourself just for
the
record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Matthew Keeling, Central Coast Water Board.
Yes, I recognize you, Matt. So you're engaged in discussion with 10 agencies, verbal commitments from 4, and you've started to design a process by which that data can be transferred or downloaded or somehow translated into GeoTracker input.
There's currently two ways we can go about this. In the long term, what we would like to see is a specific module developed for GeoTracker that is tailored towards regional groundwater monitoring program. Doing so could be a lengthy process that would need to go through a feasibility study report and a budget needs analysis. And so we've developed a concept proposal to do that. But at the same time, what we will likely be able to do in the near term is just begin populating GeoTracker with those data without actually having a more robust structure that has specific tools that we can use to evaluate the program and track those regional monitoring programs as they are developed over time.
So are the 4 agencies, is that small data sets that you feel it's worth the time, there's value in going through whatever data? Are you talking about data entry? Translating from hard copy, or what did we talk about?
Well, it depends on the agencies that we're working with and their current capacity in the way of what their database structures look like, as well as the laboratories that they currently contract with to do the analytical work. Mm-hmm. In the cases where they're contracting with laboratories that are already what we call EDF, electronic deliverable format, savvy, which is kind of the software speak for the tool that allows GeoTracker to receive data mm-hmm. from a laboratory. In that case, it basically what we need to do is take the local agency data and how they define the different fields or parameters mm-hmm. of those data and translate it into what GeoTracker will understand on the receiving end. So mm-hmm. we're currently in discussion with various laboratories, Gamma program, and then even potentially third-party contractors or an in-house staff that can help us develop that translator tool, if you will, mm-hmm. to communicate the data into GeoTracker.
Well, it sounds good to hear what sounds to me like baby steps, careful kind of looking at what the possibilities are for being efficient in looking more broadly when you get to the point of extending into bigger agencies or bigger data sets. And then the last question I have for you is, how much of this data do you think will bring into perspective those small systems, less than 15 connections? Is that even on the map?
Well, for the most part, it will not. What we've been targeting primarily have been local agency programs that have what we call agency-owned and managed wells, networks.
Okay.
As you recall in our discussion back in May, there was a concern about some local agencies that rely on privately owned wells, be it agricultural supply wells or private wells, to do their regional monitoring. They were concerned that if they were to share those data with us, they perhaps may lose access to those wells. So we've been focusing primarily on the agencies that have agency-owned wells, and they're willing to share those data with us from those wells.
Okay. That puts it in perspective.
With the case of the Monterey County Water Resource Agency and working with Monterey County Environmental Health Department, mm-hmm. Our approach there is twofold. Currently, the county health department does a lot of their own drinking water quality monitoring for small water systems,
okay.
which would be the 15 below the 15 service connection criteria for the large, for community water systems. And so, if we can get the county's laboratory to upgrade their what we call it's a laboratory information management system, it's basically mm-hmm. the program that manages their data.
Mm-hmm.
We're currently working with them to, as part of their current process to upgrade their LIMS, Laboratory Information Management System, to include a electronic deliverable format module in that upgrade that will allow them to transmit the drinking water well data that they're collecting into GeoTracker. We're still in discussion with the health department on that. They're a little bit more cautious. You know, because of their dealings with California Department of Public Health in administering the drinking water program. But on the other hand, by getting their laboratory upgraded to do GeoTracker, we will be able to capture groundwater data from the Monterey County Water Resource Agency, 36 dedicated monitoring wells that they have throughout the Salinas Valley.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear good progress. Yeah, this
thank
is
you.
A real tough area. So, okay. Thank you.
Any other questions on the Yale report?
Yeah.
Mayor Delgado.
I wanted to ask Ken something about what Matthew just said. If legislation were to go through, this early legislation we've heard about, where the drinking water standard program would be merged underneath the State Water Board, would that make data sharing, as we've just discussed, more likely to happen?
That's as far as I would even venture.
Depends.
Mm-hmm. Is that it might. You know, like, that if that legislation actually passes, that will be a huge change to the structure of state government.
Okay.
And I just, you know, the culture, there are differences in culture, there are differences in internal structure, differences in offices, differences in data systems. I mean, it's going to be a big task to merge them into the State Water Board.
But I think Matthew was saying that there's some reluctance to even go in that direction. And I'm wondering if there'd be less reluctance if it was a merged department.
Well, if they're under the executive director of the State Water Board, then they're going to take their orders from the executive director of the State Water Board.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
My understanding of how the current legislation is currently written, it doesn't change the current structure of the drinking water program, per se. It just transfers it from California Department of Public Health to the State Water Board. And so right now, current, you know, health and safety code requirements for drinking water system reporting only applies to water systems with 15 or more service connections. And our concern, you know, throughout, you know, our ag order process and development of a GAP is being, we really need to focus on the most at-risk portion of the population that get their drinking water from shallower wells for these smaller, you know, less than 15 service connection systems. And that's currently why it's uncertain whether or not there be the legislation will change that.
Okay. Thank you for your
thank you
comments. Let's no food yet, right? Okay. So let's jump to the enforcement report, and we'll hear from.
And while Harvey's coming up, I want to pass along as the final comment on the EO report is I want to pass along a compliment to you all. And I'll be sure to mention it to staff next week. Is when I was in Sacramento, I had someone who was who I respect. I think is a very smart person. Made a nice compliment when they said Region 3 was a thinking region, and they only mentioned one other region in that context, and said the rest of them just kind of go about and do their business. But this region was really a group of thinkers in terms of staff's creativity and what they tried to do. And I thought that was a very, very nice compliment.
And we don't necessarily think fast.
I didn't say the board. I said the staff.
Yeah. Chair. And, Chair, and you heard that. Can you tell us what type of person said that? A State Water Board person?
No, I think I'll keep that to myself. But I think it was someone I respect. I thought it was a very nice compliment.
We have known that, Mr. Harris. I want you to know that. Since I've been on this board.
So that just reaffirms what you thought.
Yeah, of course. I'm not surprised.
Now, can we use that credit for something, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, we want
what would you like, yeah, Mr. Jeffries?
I don't know. I'm glad we got some credit, finally.
So we don't
finally.
Think later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. You're supposed to comply regardless, Mr. Jeffries.
Always.
Chair
okay.
Young?
Yes.
I am sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
But it did slip by me that I had submitted questions on the Los Osos dewatering update, and I received a response from Ken that he was going to pass it along to staff. I didn't know if we had more information. If we don't, that's fine too, but I just wanted
Dave,
if somebody
ready
prepared a response.
To answer some of those questions.
We want to hear it. Thank you. Sorry, Harvey. Just preempt you for a few minutes.
Hello again, David Licaro, permitting staff. Yes, I did receive the questions from you, Dr. Hunter. Going through the questions, most of them were specific to I identified when timelines of when dewatering was going to begin with, and this is in relation to the collection system installation in Los Osos. Obviously, folks who have been out there, they have started trenching, activities have begun. The question is, when will areas and B start excavation? From my understanding, they haven't excavated the areas in A and B that are identified with high groundwater to be expected for dewatering. So I expect that there's going to be some sort of a schedule. Let me back up. The contractors who are doing the excavation, the construction work, have not developed yet or formalized any dewatering plan. So we're hoping to see those fairly soon. And so we're hoping that once those dewatering plans become available, that they will identify a schedule for when these portions that do have these areas in Los Osos that do have higher groundwater, those will be scheduled out so that the disposal areas will be able to accommodate as they're scheduling through the difficult excavations in those areas. So at this point, I really don't have an answer as far as when those areas are going to be excavated. That would be more of a question for the county. I did, just to let you know, tried to touch base with county staff yesterday. Haven't received anything yet in regards to scheduling for those excavations or when we anticipate a dewatering plan is going to come our way. So I'm hoping that response is going to come soon. I did, however, since December, we gave an update. December 3rd, we sent the county a request for them to submit an application for dewatering discharges to land, which I have in front of me. I received that on the 25th. I went through that just kind of a cursory review yesterday. I'm trying to get through the details as much as possible so that we can begin the process of approving a waiver for those discharges. Let's see, what other questions did you have? There were some other questions with respect to
disposal to land, and actually under the same category of monitoring for fecal coliform bacteria, disposal to land and disposal to marine waters.
Right, and that was one of the things that we wanted to make sure we were clear with county staff and, of course, subsequently their contractors. They are going on the approach that limited discharges to the bay. As far as they're concerned, if they can keep a majority of the encountered dewater that they're getting, the encountered groundwater as they're doing their excavation activities, if they can keep that to the disposal of their already identified areas, the Midtown site, the Broderson once that becomes available, and some of the infiltration basins scattered around town. Mm-hmm. They're going to try to, as best as possible, keep those as the primary discharge locations. And then as a follow-up, if there is a circumstance where they need to discharge to surface waters, then they've indicated in their initial dewatering plan, their initial conceptual dewatering plan that was submitted a while back, that they would be discharging to various storm drains throughout the community that then obviously lead out into to Morro Bay. One of the things that we had issue with was the salinity. Well, let me talk about salinity really quick. So with regard to salinity, one of the approaches that we're looking at is certainly we don't want to degrade what's existing groundwater-wise. And so we've talked to the county about implementing some sort of a monitoring program that is going to measure salinity when they are approaching those areas that are near the bay and doing those excavations. So then they can use those meters or monitoring program to figure out whether this groundwater is elevated in TDS or salinity to the extent that it's not going to impair any inland groundwater resources there. So we've talked about either some sort of, there's a lot of things on the market now that are handheld meters that can test for salinity and TDS on the spot. So it would make it a lot easier and cost effective for the contractors when they're out there on the site. Do we want to talk about bacteria?
I was just going to point out that this is Harvey Packard. The stormwater enrollment that we issued a couple of years ago did include bacterial effluent limitations for any discharges to the bay. So that's already covered.
Okay. So so I think, you know, just if I could encapsulate really quickly, my concern is where they find themselves with inflow, bay inflow, I think is what the county calls it. So it means they've opened up an excavation that now they have continuous water that is coming in, that is saline. And so, you know, what they do in that situation, that seems to me like the worst case scenario, and that's really what I'm trying to understand. What are the contingency plans for accommodating an excavation that is got to be pumped continuously, and that there is fecal coliform in the water, and that it has a saline content? So now you've narrowed down the options, and this is where I am, you know, looking to see that the contractors and the county have defined for themselves how they're going to meet the challenge that this might entail, because it's always easy to come back and say, well, we didn't have any choice. We had to start pumping it into the bay. In that case, it's not the saline, but the fecal coliform levels that could be hugely important. And I think we had a memo, an informal exchange with State Board and some folks who have done recently completed research. And they expressed thoughts, suggestions that we should look at disposal sites very carefully and define for the county best locations to avoid impacts to the Back Bay, which suffers from low tidal flow. So, because that means there wouldn't be mixing, there's bird habitat, you know, it's a national estuary. And we have heard repeatedly from the community that this is a huge concern. I myself worked on bringing that national estuary online for various reasons, and I think it would be a tragedy not to plan, not to see a plan for contingency for worst case, because we know that the area, the streets along the bay are very likely to see bay inflow. County said it. They've acknowledged it. I hope their contractors can provide us with a very clear picture of what will happen.
Right, and they're aware of it. We're aware of it. We even, you know, we gave them the permit to discharge to the bay, and it has the bacterial effluent limitations. When that water is too saline for on-land disposal, about the only option is to the bay. I'd suggest that we add that to the agenda for that subcommittee meeting. And I know the county's aware of it. I don't know how structured their plan is to deal with it.
Yeah. Well, so hopefully when we set that up, as we did before, we can send them a list of questions so that hopefully we can use our time productively so they're aware.
If I may, Dr. Hunter,
I
think if we could allow the county to get up to speed in getting those dewatering plans to us first, certainly we can put it through the level of scrutiny that making sure that they will be abiding by the discharge prohibitions we set forth in the memo, you know, and so, but I'm thinking that maybe the dewatering plan might shed a little light on some of the questions we might have today with regard to these contingencies that you might be referring to. But absolutely, we're still holding their feet to the fire and making sure that we do get a dewatering plan. They are now, or will be soon, held under discharges to land, so that there are going to be limitations there or conditions of approval with regard to the waiver and discharges to land. They're already covered under the MPDS mm-hmm. construction stormwater permit, mm-hmm. so they are now held to requirements specific to discharges to surface water bodies, mm-hmm. and that does include the list of fecal coliform ammonia, which is something that we haven't talked about,
right.
and certainly salinity is in there as well. And I don't want to discount the conversations that we did have with state board staff, because I found those highly informational, and being able to kind of wrap that into how we're conceiving this project and the construction as we move forward, I think it was very valuable. So I'm waiting for this dewatering plan to come forward, and I think that might hopefully answer some of the questions that you have.
Good. I hope they call you back soon.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, David.
Okay. Thank you very much.